Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to Military Monday with your host, John Gresham. It's a snowy Monday afternoon here in Fairfax, Virginia. And we have today someone who is both a longtime friend and one of the best in the business when it comes to the art of multitasking. You've often heard about, you know, triple threat ball players and such. You can play multiple positions or sports. Well, today you get to meet one of the best multiple players in the business of the media. Let me introduce you to my friend, my colleague, occasional co-author, and good friend, again, Larry Bond. Are you there, Larry? Hang on. Are you there, Larry?
John, are you there?
I am.
I can hear you, yes.
Yes.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, thank you for coming on. For those of you who are not familiar with Larry, Larry is a author, game designer, and jack of all trades in the media business. I first met him many years ago because he was the designer of a rather nice little tactical modern wargaming system called Harpoon, which is now in its, what, fourth or fifth iteration, Larry?
Depends upon which game you're talking about, but yes.
We will talk more about that. But that particular game led to a visit from a gentleman author by the name of Tom Clancy. And then from there, I'm going to let you tell a little bit about what happened to you, Larry.
Oh, geez. Yes, Tom, we encourage people to send in questions about modern naval combat, which was what the game was about. And I got one from a guy who was an insurance agent in rural Maryland. Very knowledgeable, but had a bunch of fairly deep questions. I answer his letter, which is why I always answer my mail. And we became good friends. And it turned out he was working on a book called The Hunt for Red October. And his name was Tom Clancy. And
nothing book, nothing movie, nothing anything, right?
I mean, it was just, well, he'd always been interested in naval warfare and military stuff in general, but his eyes were way too bad for him to ever enter the service, or I'm sure he would have. The book was an amazing success, of course.
And as anybody who has read his stuff knows, as good as Tom is with the technology, it's his storytelling that just captures you.
Absolutely. He is a born storyteller. He did visit the Blarney Stone in England or in Ireland, but from what I understand, he didn't kiss it. He bit and chewed. He talks stories, you know, anecdotes, recollections. It's his method of conversation. And we became good friends. We worked together on a second book, which became Red Storm Rising, which was a tremendous success. I will not claim to have authored more than one word out of 100 in that book. I billed as co-author, but I was really his apprentice, you know, and if you're going to study, you know, apprentice under somebody like Tom Clancy.
It worked for me. It worked for you. It's worked for a couple of people.
Well, yeah, my favorite story is that we blew the doors off of Daniel Steele, and that made it for me.
With all due respect to Larry's humility, it's worth noting that Red Storm Rising was the single most sold and lucrative literary property of the 1980s.
I would say one of. I didn't know it was the, but
yeah,
I wouldn't surprise
one. Me. I checked.
Wow. What I like is the fact that the Naval War College was using it as a case study, and that the government of Iceland actually renegotiated their reinforcement treaty with NATO based on that book. Because when we were researching it, and this is one of the things you learned from Tom Clancy, is you just ask the people involved flat questions. And, you know, no, they're not going to call in an airstrike. I mean, Tom Clancy wrote a letter to the ambassador of Iceland saying, hi, we're going to write a book about your country being invaded. Could you send us some information? And we not only got back written material that would choke a camel, but we also got back videotapes and a very nice letter saying, if you need to know anything else specific, just let me know. So we asked the people involved, and before the book was written, or at the time of the book's writing, there were NATO forces stationed in Iceland. But if you wanted to reinforce that base, if you wanted to bring in a new 45 caliber pistol that wasn't in the list of approved weapons for NATO to have on that base, it had to be negotiated at the State Department foreign minister level ahead of time. This is not conducive to rapid reinforcement in time of war, and we showed how that worked to their disadvantage in the book.
So, indeed.
That's my favorite story.
And after you worked with Tom on that, you then began to write your own novels, correct?
Yeah, I was working as a naval analyst after I got out of the Navy and was doing okay at it, but this O'John O'Marsha stuff was a lot more fun, paid well enough to pay the rent, and I got to pick my own projects. And so I quit my day job in 1986, and I've been peddling like crazy ever since.
Again, we're talking with Larry Bond, and if you'd like to call in and talk to him or me, the call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Please feel free to give a call, and we'll take a break and talk to you if you do. Larry, now, one of the things that comes from writing the particular genre that you have been working in, the well-known techno-thriller, and really it's more crisis thrillers in a lot of ways, is that you've gotten a handle on some of the biggest international security crises of the past quarter century. You've gotten to look them up and down and be able to keep a very close eye on them over time. Correct me if I'm wrong. You've written about North Korea. You've written about Iran. You've written about the Middle East, correct?
Absolutely. I like the term crisis thriller, by the way. I may steal that. I'm not sure.
It's out in the open. It's yours to have. But in these crisis thrillers, you wind up spending a lot of time looking at everything from Lonely Planet travel guides to reading The Economist to watching social media and other news sources, and in some cases even using your own games to go ahead and provide you material for the scenarios that you write about, correct?
That is all correct.
How does this process all come together between your ears when it finally comes time to write about it?
Well, what I'm looking for is forces and influences and the complexities of the crisis. Most of these crises exist because they have no simple solution. And the books we write don't try and solve anything. As a matter of fact, the books we start usually solve with the crisis being unsolved and escalating. My charter as a military thriller writer or a crisis thriller writer is to knock the props out in chapter one, and after that, see how things develop and how they flow. Plausibly, not the most probable solution, because the most probable solution so far, thank goodness, seems to be that most people go, no, that's too much. Let's dial it back. This is not where we want to go. But once in a while, and unfortunately, as history shows, things don't always work out for the best, and the lid comes off, and things go crazy. What I found out is that doing that kind of background research, I can identify the trends and the social influences and the things that would show up in the story. And it's all grist for the mill. It can be some little thing that turns out to be very important in the long term. The idea is to research and get as close to the truth as possible, because the thrill in Thriller comes from that sense of reality. It comes from, yeah, I just read about something about that in paper, or yeah, I know that's going on over there, and this is one way it could go. We want to be as close to the truth as possible. Plus, it's a lot easier to just research it and remember stuff than have to make stuff up and have to be internally consistent with the made-up stuff.
That old saying that we can't make this stuff up, we just read the news and repeat it.
Well, the first book I ever worked on, Red Phoenix, it was going to be about the North invading the South, which, you know, they worry about all the time. So that wasn't a real stretch of
North
the imagination.
North Korea.
North Korea invading South Korea. And no great inspiration to write a book there. That situation is still very tense. The North Koreans to this day make real good Klingons. What I learned was when I said I want one of my characters to be an F-16 pilot, and I talked to the Air Force because I had a couple questions I wanted to ask an F-16 driver about things and stuff. And they says, oh, well, we'll send you down to Moody Air Force Base. And I'm going, come on, I live in Virginia. Don't you have an F-16 pilot over at the Pentagon somewhere I can talk to? I just need a couple questions answered. They says, no, trust us. We're going to send you down to Moody Air Force Base. You'll love it.
And
well,
what
you know,
did
it wasn't
they do
like
with you
drafted.
Down at
Moody? It was for a weekend. I figured, what can they do to me? On the other hand, this is the Air Force. I landed at the world's smallest international airport. Moody Air Force Base is like I don't even remember the name of the town next to Moody Air Force Base, but it's this little bitty airport with a one-story hangar. A control tower. It's like one story above ground level, and which is plenty far. You can see everything at that airport just fine with that little bitty control tower. Then you go a short drive, and here's the world's largest airbase. You can land, you know, C-141's line abreast. I mean, it's immense. And they drive me into the what was then the 69th Tactical Fighter Squadron's Operation Shack and drop me off. Have a nice day. And the guys immediately start showing me stuff I had no idea existed and would be tremendous material for the book. In other words, it's the stuff I didn't know that I needed to know.
Little things like ejection seats and multifunction displays and
I played Falcon. I was up on the HUD and everything and all the knobology. But what I wasn't up on was the culture. I talked to the ops officer, sketched out who this character was going to be. He was going to be a captain in the Air Force and have with the 8th Tactical Fighter Wing, which is the Wolf Pack, and they're based in Kunsan, Korea. And turned out the officer had served at Kunsan in the 8th Wing, so this is great. And his first question was, okay, is he a Panton or a Juvet? And I'm going, in my typically articulate way, duh.
These are the nicknames of the two squadrons that serve over there.
Yes, and he's giving me a layout of the base and the stuff they pull on each other and the Norton Nickel and all this other stuff. These little bits of fighter pilot culture that really make up their day to day existence. And it's not like it's not like Top Gun, please. Please, but it is a part of their life, and by getting some of that into the story, I made it much more real. And they really got into it. At one point in Red Phoenix, our hero gets hit by enemy anti-aircraft fire, and he has to eject. But I didn't want him to eject too close to the scene of the crime. I wanted him to get a little bit away, and then he was going to bail out and have to escape and evade and this and that. And they were helping me identify exactly which widget on the F-16 could get shot out so that could happen. And then because he was going to bail out, they actually had me work with their life support officer. And this is the guy that teaches fighter pilots how to eject from airplanes. How cool is that?
And not die.
Yeah, and not die. And that's an important part because it turns out, again, I did not understand this, it's an incredibly violent process. You just don't pop the canopy and and step out and open the chute. It's a lot more complicated than that. First of all, the ejection seat charge is like a 40-millimeter cannon shell into your butt. So he's talking about how you have to keep your spine straight or you're going to have back problems for the rest of your life. Then he's talking about the slipstream outside the cockpit, which is probably about 30 degrees below zero and is going by at, what's the stalling speed on an F-16? It's going, what, at least 150 knots?
About 150, 170, yeah.
Yeah, and probably higher than that if you haven't had a chance to slow down first. Luckily, thanks to his schooling, I had Tony in the book actually slow the aircraft down and do all the things that you get to do. So it was a virtually perfect ejection. I say virtually because, again, working with a life support officer, he says, you reach down, you grab the yellow handles, and yank for all you're worth. I says, what happens if they don't work? What happens if it's been shot out or something? He goes, oh, okay, well, then you do this, and then you can reach behind and do that. And I'm going, really? So I had Tony yank the handles and nothing happened. And then he got to do the number two thing, which is you reach over very carefully. I mean, you know, your arm elbows are tucked in, and you reach over and hit the switch that opens the canopy. Now you're in flight, which is normally not indicated for this kind of thing. But what happens is, as the canopy rises, the slipstream catches it and yanks it. And a bungee cord is connected to the explosive charge, which fires, and then you go out. This is not recommended as the best way to get out, because there's a chance you're tangling up the canopy. But it's better than a sharp stick in the eye. So a lot of that kind of stuff. I mean, that's a long story, but it was just one short
scene. But it makes sense.
Scene.
It tells people a process that we do as we write, whether it's history, the crisis thriller, or just trying to describe what people do in these circumstances. And with that kind of thought in mind, we'd like to talk a little bit about some of the crises running around the world, as there are a couple of them that are getting a little nasty and impressive at the same time. And that said, let's start with the one you maybe keep the closest eye on, just out of personal habit, and that is Korea. What is it you see in Korea going on right now as someone who has spent much of the last quarter century observing Korea, both in the research and follow-up to Red Phoenix?
Well, it's fascinating to watch Kim Jong-un come in. I mean, we are now sort of where the book was when we started writing it, was Kim Jong-il. His father had just come into power from Kim Il-sung and was trying to acquire all the power he needed from wherever they have it lying around up there in the leadership. And plus, you combine that with a unstable situation in the South, and that provided the trigger for the war. Kim Jong-un has a different issue. He seems to be generating his own crises, doing his level best to poke a stick in our eye whenever he wants to. We know more about North Korea now than we did when we wrote the book, and I would have loved to put in some of the stuff that we've learned about their counterfeiting operations, their drug running, it's basically a massive criminal enterprise being, you know, masquerading as a country. What's going to happen?
In other words, they produce counterfeit narcotics and at the same time go and are conducting acts of transnational crime to go ahead and export them out to other countries in the region and such?
Absolutely. There's money laundering. There's stuff being brought. Obviously, the leadership lives a very different life from the average citizen who is getting by with rocks in his diet at least once every meal.
And correct me if I'm wrong, these people are world-class counterfeiters, not only of currencies, but also of other legal financial documents across the planet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the only honest job they've got, the only honest source of income, if you want to call that, is that they sell weapons to anybody and everybody. So if Iran needs stuff or Syria or somebody like that, they're more than happy to provide them. Of course, there are sometimes some issues getting them to the customer, but you know, that's usually covered under the insurance clause.
And when we talk weapons, we're talking ballistic and cruise missiles,
mm-hmm.
as well as there are indications of them exporting elements of their own nuclear technology, correct?
Well, we know that they've exported elements of their own nuclear technology because the Iranian heavy water reactor at Arak looks a whole lot like the NK-1 reactor in North Korea.
And did not the Syrians buy a turnkey enrichment plant that the Israelis destroyed a few years ago?
Yes, and the rumor was that a few North Koreans also bought it when the Israelis hit the reactor. So, yes, Kim Jong-un is the last inheritor of a family business. And if you want to look for what's going to happen to the country, I suggest you look for what happened, you know, the downfall of a mafia family or a corrupt business enterprise more than in models of national behavior.
Really? Care to provide any insights on what the model for that kind of a fall might be? Can you make
I would love to. If I hadn't already written a book on North Korea, it would be a great time to do it. Not to mention the fact that I'm already typing on some other stuff like a crazy man. But an internal power struggle. You know, there was every risk that Kim Jong-un could have been swept aside by the military leadership, and they would have taken over as a junta, which might have actually been an improvement over the current civilian leadership, or it could have been different factions within the family. It's clear that the only people who are trusted by the Kims are other Kims, brothers-in-law, sisters-in-law, and I suspect, you know, if you marry into that clan, I don't know how do I want to say this. It's something you can't get a divorce. You can't say these guys are nuts, I'm leaving. Once you're in, you're in, and you're given. Okay, you're one of us now. Here's the army.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, you can run the army, and you know they've run a good profit over the past decade, so you'll do fine.
Which raises an interesting question. As you sit here today watching the Korean Peninsula seethe with instability at the moment, want to take any guesses what the next crazy thing that happens is?
Oh, it's you know, could be all of the above. We've seen him shell islands in the neutral territory. He fires off missiles.
Sank a South Korean corvette recently.
Yeah. That was the most egregious thing, and the fact that nothing happened to them as a result tells him that that's where the line is. The problem is that Kim Jong-un is the new kid, and while he certainly has studied under the master of provocation and going up, I'm not touching the line, I'm not touching the line, he can always miscalculate and provoke a reaction which could involve South Korea, and if it does, it automatically involves us because we're pledged to defend South Korea, which I totally approve of, by the way. But it could end up, you know, we wake up one morning and all of a sudden find out that we're involved in an armed conflict with North Korea. Not that we couldn't win handily. These guys, while they have a large army, are not in a position to project power, to use it effectively. And it's not clear whether their army can do much beyond march smartly at political parades. But it would still be
on the
messy.
Other hand, this is a country with nuclear weapons capability of some level.
Yes, they have some nukes. Where they are is probably one of the really important intelligence issues that we try and keep track of, whether we do or not, I don't know. Yeah, control of the nukes. I mean, imagine that within House Un. As you know, which one of the family members has actual control of the nukes, knows where they are, and has custody of them for Kim Jong-un? How's that for somebody you want to have on your good side?
I'd just like to have a phone. I'd just like to have a direct conduit to them and know when something happens. But then again, I'm sure that's what people in various federal agencies and other places are desperately trying to figure out right now.
It's one always hopes for the kind of virtual collapse, bloodless change of power that happened in the Soviet Union or the Philippines, where a dictatorial regime fell with relatively little loss of life. But there's always a chance that it's going to go south, and people will get hurt for no good reason, which is always a crying shame.
People sometimes forget that the so-called Velvet Revolution of 1989, which was, other than Romania, relatively bloodless, could have gone a lot of different ways, given all of the players and all of the circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, well, you and I both grew up in the Cold War era, and we fully expected that when the Soviet Union finally went, it was going to be in flames, because those guys were in power, and they didn't want to give it up. How are we going to know that, you know, one day they open their wallets and there's nothing in there, and they decided to turn out the lights and lock up and leave?
Yeah, I certainly didn't figure that was going to happen. I know you were just as surprised as I was.
Well, there were a lot of economists at Center for Naval Analysis, where I was stationed for a couple of years while I was still in the Navy. It's a think tank for the Navy, and typical questions are, how many carriers will we need in 20 years? Show your work. You talk about word problems. So there were economists there who were saying, you know, they're spending so much on their defense sector of their economy that the whole thing's going to grind to a halt. The economy's going to collapse because, you know, the numbers that they're giving are fake. The real numbers are much higher. And we're all going, yeah, sure, you know. And, you know, when was the last time an economist was right? Well, this one time they were.
Well, probably because they weren't evaluating our economy. They were doing a third-person search, as in their economy, and they're much better at that.
Well, also, when the flaw is as egregious as spending up to 25 or 30% of your gross domestic product on weapons, which you can't eat and can't build anything else with, even most economists could agree on that. It's all this subtle stuff that gives them trouble.
Let's talk about another area of crisis that you've recently written about, and that is Iran. You recently completed a novel on the Iranian situation. The name of that one was?
Exit Plan. Thank you very much. That one's been doing very well. That came out about a year ago, and it had, 2 years ago, actually. Has it been that long? Yes.
Time flies when we're having fun, Larry.
Well, yeah, because it came out, and then the paperback is out now, available at Amazon and other fine retailers. We took a very different tack. I mean, the whole question of whether or not they're building a bomb, of course they're building a bomb. Come on, guys. But
we can watch them building the bomb, places that build the bombs.
Exactly. And these days, with the satellite tracking and Google Earth and other things, you got no problem just sitting there and looking at everything. And we came up with, what if they're not doing well? And we know that they're having problems. I mean, if they weren't having problems, they'd already have a bomb, and this would be a whole different issue. But they're having technical problems. The Arak reactor, which is supposedly the copy of the North Korean facility, it looks like that. It's not an exact copy, because they're having problems with water heating within the reactor core. Now, of course, water is supposed to be heated in the core, but it's not supposed to turn into steam, because if it turns into steam, it makes bubbles, and bubbles no longer provide good heat conductivity, and it quickly gets into things that nuclear engineers will understand and explain it to me, and I start, it's just not making a lot of sense. Bottom line, they can't make it work yet. So they're trying to solve it. We know that they're centrifuge technology, because we've managed to prevent them from getting things like meranging steel. Is that how you pronounce it?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh, meranging steel, which is a very high-quality steel, which is used in things like missiles and nuclear centrifuges. They can't get any of that, so they've got to do things like fiber resin compounds and other more exotic materials, which they can get and can work with, but produce very poor centrifuges. They just recently claimed that they now have a true second-generation centrifuge and are installing about 3,000 plus of them at a place called Fordow, which is near the the city of Qom in Quran, in Iran. And what they're going to do with that centrifuge technology remains to be seen. But, yeah, that will help them if they want to turn enriched uranium into highly enriched uranium. The more centrifuges, the quicker it goes.
So we have Iran, which wants the bomb in the worst way.
Yes. In the worst way that they intend to use it in the worst way, by the way.
Or so have stated in no uncertain terms. They, as soon as they can weaponize it, they intend to stick it on top of a missile and lob it towards Israel as their first and currently only proclaimed target, correct?
Correct, but not complete. One of my theories, which I put out, and this is my personal theory, but I haven't found anybody who disagrees with it, is that they're not going to put the first bomb on the missile. They're going to wait till they got two or three or more, because if you make one bomb and then use it right away and they get mad and come back at you, you got nothing left. So you always want to have more than one bullet in the pistol. Otherwise, you know, you've just signed into a suicide pact. Because, if they do fire a nuke at Israel, Israel will respond, and it will not be pleasant for Iran. And I found a lot of people who are saying, okay, well, they just want it for deterrence because, you know, once they have the bomb, they can go to Israel and say, you have to get rid of your bombs because we have bombs too. And that works with a rational state. On the other hand, Ahmadinejad has, on many times, denied the Holocaust existed and at the same time complained that they didn't finish the job. Explain that to me, please.
And it's worth pointing out, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, the crises areas we've just been talking about, North Korea, Iran, we're going to talk a little about Syria here in a few minutes, none of these are headed by what would be called rational actors in the context that you and I understand that, correct?
Yes. The Iranian leadership all practices Twelver Shia Islam, which in my limited understanding involves the fact that the 12th Imam has occulted and is it someday going to make his return. In some ways, it's very similar to Christian religions and the second coming of Jesus and this and that. And again, like the Christian religion, the Imam will appear in a time of crisis. There will be there will be chaos. There will be dogs and cats getting married. I mean, all kinds of things are going to be going on, and he will appear. What worries people is that there are some 12er Shia disciples who believe that it's their job to create that chaos and to bring it on, because that will accelerate the return of the Imam.
And sadly, many of them are senior leaders within the Iranian government and their religious leadership.
This is my concern. A lot of people are dismiss Ahmadinejad's rhetoric because, well, first of all, he's not the head top guy in charge. Khamenei is the supreme leader, is the guy who really makes all the decisions. Ahmadinejad's more like an executive officer who runs the day-to-day stuff. He has a voice in policy, but if he says anything that Khamenei doesn't agree with, he just gets shut down. And they're having power struggles over there all the time. But,
by the way, for our listeners, that's the Ayatollah Khatami who heads the religious council of imams there in Iran.
Yes, yes. And actually, I'll have to correct you, John. He is a grand Ayatollah.
Oh, hey, sorry.
Well, it's just an important point because when he came up for membership or to be the supreme leader, where he would be chosen by a council of learned men, only grand ayatollahs can qualify. The Iranian constitution is written so that only grand ayatollahs can be the supreme leader. He was only an ayatollah. How do you get to be a grand ayatollah? You publish, you do a lot of learned things. And so he very quickly kicked out a couple of monographs, and everybody looked at him and said, okay, now you're a grand ayatollah. And then they made him the supreme leader. So he's really kind of a junior Grand Ayatollah, if point be known. But these guys say things publicly that most national leaders would never say. They talk about obliterating Israel routinely. They talk about raining fire and destruction. And you go, well, they're just preaching to the home folks. This is for local consumption. This is not really their foreign policy. This is just them just stoking the domestic politics. And then you say to yourself, so the average Iranian man in the street really wants to obliviate Israel. Is that what you're saying? Because if he does, then when the Iranian leadership says, you know what, we could obliviate Israel, who's going to stop him?
Not to mention the rather large Shia population along the south coast of the Persian Gulf from Bahrain down to Qatar, which listens to that Iranian rhetoric regularly.
Absolutely. There are different disciplines within the Shia religion, but the Iranians really believe that the 12 are Shia. I don't want to use the word sect. I don't know what the proper word is, but the 12 are Shia is the strongest one. And they would certainly like to be the religious leadership of the Muslim world. There's no question of that.
We've been talking about the atomic weapons program there, but we also need to acknowledge the fact that the Iranian military infrastructure is very, very well put together and is developing. They're already producing, obviously, ballistic and cruise missiles in prodigious numbers. They're producing ordnance, including precision-guided ordnance for aircraft and ships, and slowly but surely playing around with their own indigenous aircraft. What do you see Iran becoming in the next 5 to 10 years in terms of a player on the world weapons market?
The Iranians would love to sell their stuff abroad. As far as light weapons, infantry weapons go, they can kick out as much of that stuff as they want. They still, while they claim to have a couple of new aircraft designs, they really strongly resemble existing Western aircraft designs with very small tweaks. For instance, they have an aircraft called the Sagay, I believe, if I'm pronouncing it properly, which looks a heck of a lot like an F-5 with two tails. And there are aeronautical experts who are going, I don't see where a V-tail on an F-5 gives you much. But it looks different, and they're very proud of it. And they want very much to build up their indigenous industrial capacity, just in general, but especially in terms of weapons that they can export. I'm not convinced that when they send stuff to Hezbollah and other groups, as we know they are, because we intercept ships full of weapons headed for trouble spots that come from Iran, I'm not sure that Hezbollah doesn't have to pay some serious change to Iran to get that stuff. They're not giving it away just for the sake of Islamic solidarity. They need the bucks.
Because they themselves are under a fairly heavy sanctions regime these days.
They are. And the IRGC and the other power factions within Iran have been going business concerns for a long time. But sanctions on bank transfers and other things. For instance, there was a sanction that the administration put in place about a year ago, I believe, which prevents a maritime insurance organization from providing certificates to Iranian vessels that they are fit to enter port. And what that does is it prevents any Iranian-flagged vessel from entering most ports, because without that certificate, you're not covered. You're forbidden.
The port owners just won't let you in to offload your cargo.
Exactly. And it's had a tremendous effect. There are other – it can be very subtle things, but the sanctions are having an effect. They are driving up prices. They are hurting the Iranian man in the street, and probably the leadership, who's catching a lot of heat, whether it's enough to cause the regime change or anything like that. Actually, I don't think a regime change would help us. What we need is an attitude change, where their entire government philosophy is not based on poking, prodding, and insulting everybody they can find.
Particularly the great Satan and the little Satan.
Well, it's you know, you have Israel over here, which is somewhat justifiably concerned with their national security. They're sensitive, and I get that. And here you've got these other guys who are continually, I'm going to get you, I'm going to get you, I'm going to get you. Tell me how this can end well.
Not likely. And for our listeners, if you want to talk to Larry, call-in line is 347-945-7246 if you have a question for Larry or myself. Larry, let's go on and talk about that last festering wound in the region, and that's Syria. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but what we have here is a not entirely warm and fuzzy national government under the Assad regime being assaulted by no less than 7 or 8 various regionally and religiously oriented faction groups trying to break it down and then take over the entity previously known as Syria. Take it from there. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, you got it right about the 7, you know, multiple groups. I don't know how many there are. I have lost count. And shifting alliances, it's the old story. During any revolution, you will grab anybody with a gun who's willing to shoot at the leadership. And, you know, you sort out their pedigree later on after you're in power. The problem is that it's not always you who end up sitting in the capital when it's over. These guys they're desperate. If I was in their situation, I don't know if I'd behave any differently. The Assad regime has shown itself to be more brutal than we could have ever imagined, and they're hanging on in spite of every indication that history is not on their side. I'm trying to figure out why Bashar Assad is hanging around.
I mean, common sense would dictate load up bags full of gold bullion and get out of town and find a non-extradition country, right?
Exactly, and there are places that would take him. I don't want to insult any country by naming them as a possibility, but there are places where he could go and do a Papa Doc and simply live in relative luxury for the remainder of his life. Now, maybe he doesn't figure his life's going to be that long if he leaves, but it's not going to be that long if he stays. For me, the writing was on the wall when that bomb went off during a cabinet meeting, and he barely escaped with his life. And that was over a year ago, as I recall. Since then, he must be sleeping in a different bed every night.
Worked for Yasser Arafat.
Well,
which raises this question, Larry. I mean,
yeah.
As we've kind of previously said, this particular civil war, which is turning into an 8 or 9-cornered dogfight, as you and I would like to call it, is showing off levels of combat depravity that rarely have been seen even in the nastiest of race, religious, and family-based wars in the past. How low does this go? I mean, how low can it go at this point?
I don't even want to imagine. There's stuff on YouTube that'll, you know, and you hear stories that make your ears bleed. And it's, unfortunately, it's on both sides. I mean, the rebels cannot claim to have clean hands. But that's true in almost every revolution. But the Assad regime provoked it and is the main perpetrator. What worries me is the number of foreign people who are being involved in the war. And Israel is backing Assad. I'm sorry, Iran is backing Assad to the hilt. There are Iranian personnel in Syria, you know, working with the Assad regime, training them in internal security procedures. How lovely. Iranian weapons.
Isn't that the polite way of describing the beginnings of genocide?
I don't want to know. Maybe I do want to know, but I also want to stop it, obviously. The big issue in there is how much Iran and Russia and other countries have backed Assad, and whether he thinks that with their help he can somehow struggle through this and regain control. I don't think there's a chance in 10 of that happening, but that may be one of the reasons why he's hanging on, and that's to their damnation that they're sustaining the war for their own political purposes. If Assad does fall, Iranian influence in the region will be much lessened. Russian influence will be lessened, although Russia could just as easily make friends with the new regime, but they don't want to take that chance.
And there is, of course, the uncertainty that even a change is not an insurance of better.
Well, it could be an Islamist state. It would be hard to imagine them being as aggressive and grasping as the Syrian regime. They've created problems in Lebanon for years, trying to sort of amalgamate it as part of Greater Syria, which includes Iranian secret police being involved in the assassination of Lebanese politicians. Israel is all in the favor of a nice, quiet, stable Syria, even when unfriendly to Israel, but at least stable, because it's just a hop, skip, and a jump away from Tel Aviv.
And a side story that just resolved itself, or apparently resolved itself, this weekend: Turkey and Israel finally making up and being nice to each other after a particularly unpleasant incident on the high seas a couple of years ago. Your comments on that?
I am so relieved to see that happening, and you know, full credit to the president for, you know, having whatever he did, even if it was just providing political cover for the Israelis so that they felt that they could make that call to the Turks. Before this all broke down, there was a very high level of cooperation between the Israelis and the Turks, to the extent of Israelis selling weapons and upgrading Turkish weapon systems, joint exercises.
Overflight rights to hit that reactor complex on the Euphrates River in Syria a few years ago.
No, there were no overflight rights given. There were no overflight rights given. I mean, the story I got, which, you know, is as much a story as anything I write, is that, you know, the Israelis were sort of caught red-handed because they found drop tanks with Israeli markings within Turkish territory. And the Turks went to the Israelis and said, "What the hey?" However you say that in Turkish. And the Israelis,
but please don't do that again, ever.
Well, they said the Israelis showed the Turks the intel information that they used to make the decision to bomb the Syrian reactor. And after that, the Turks went to the Syrians and go, "What are you doing building a nuclear reactor right next to our border? This is not something we want." And it was a rather nice little slide of you know, who they were really mad at. But yeah, the Turks were not pleased. Nobody is pleased when you overfly their sovereign territory. But I think they were convinced that the Israelis had cause. And it's interesting that violation of sovereign territory by armed aircraft to attack another country was treated quietly by the Turks and with no real effect on their overall relations, compared to the blow up later on with the commandos landing on the ship. There's no comparison between those two incidents.
one of those classic examples of the old maxim, it's easier to ask forgiveness than permission.
That and the fact that, they could justify it. They could say, this is, you know, we had reason, and by the way, you would be interested in this. You know, this is, look at this over here. This is, did you know this was going on? The Turks are going, we didn't know that was going on. So what I'm concerned with Syria, my deepest concern is Syria, is that it will turn into a failed state, and it will just sit there and fester. And even if one of the opposition groups does manage to take the capital, they won't be able to create the strong government that's necessary to enforce their borders, to clean up the militias that have now formed. And you'll have a situation where anybody can come in and do anything. It'll be Dodge City in Damascus.
Gee, just like Beirut was once upon a time.
Yeah, and you know, parts of Iraq are still like that. And what are the Syrian Kurds thinking about, by the way?
Independence. That's what Kurds always think about.
Yeah, and you get enough Kurds thinking independence, and that's another crisis that has yet to rear its ugly head, thank goodness. Yeah.
With multiple players, including Iran, Turkey, and Syria.
Yes, yes. It'd be interesting to see those countries actually getting together and talking to each other, because none of them want the Kurds to have independence. Let's you know, that gets even messier than the current situation. I mean, the heck of it is that Assad exiling himself actually is better for him in the long run, because that preserves an element of his political power. Look at how long Muammar Gaddafi's diehards hung on, even after he'd been killed. If Assad stayed alive somewhere else, I think the Ba'athist Party would just go underground and wait for his return.
Amazing how the Ba'athist political movement has gone from the heights of the 1960s and 70s to where it is today. But such is the nature of political evolution.
Mm.
We've got about 10-15 minutes left, Larry, and I'm going to give you the chance now to talk a little bit about what you're working on now, what your recent products have been, and I'm not just talking books. I'm talking about, talk to us about the other media you work in, gaming, television, other things.
Well, I've television. I would love to get some of my stuff on. Well, that's another story. I have an agent. He's in Hollywood. Anybody wants to talk, let me know. It's mainly the books and the war games. The war games take up as much time, maybe even more than the books, but it's important to keep our hand in, and it's a lot of fun. I'm trying to come up with a better word than fun, but you know, fun just happens to fit. Researching these areas and getting familiar with the crises, and sometimes we get to recycle material. If people read Exit Plan, they will see a lot of stuff that also went into our game that we came out with two summers ago called Persian Incursion, which is about an Israeli strike on Iran. Now, we don't say
anything
about
whether... Which, by the way, got quite a bit of publicity, including people reviewing it in Foreign Policy and other rather highbrow places.
It's gotten a good rep, and we didn't try and make any particular point. We didn't say, yes, the Israelis should bomb or no, they shouldn't. That wasn't the point. It's, you know, often wargaming is people try and use it to prove a certain thing. See, Rommel should have won, or you know, the Allies, yeah, Normandy was the only place they could land because Pas-de-Calais wouldn't work. And that's not what it's about. It's about taking a problem that's too big and too complex to look to study all by its, you know, you can't look at one piece because everything's affected by everything else. Instead, you put all the pieces into free play and see which ones rise to the top, see which ones are the drivers. Now, you won't get that out of one play, but if you do two or three, you will see trends. And by the end of that, you will have a deeper understanding of the overall situation, and you will say, gee, we really need to study this more thoroughly, or we need to understand what's going on over here because we don't. And this is, and the nice thing about a war game is it's paper. It's just something you write down, and it's you lay it out, and then you play with it. And if it doesn't really work, you can change the rules, or if you find new information, you change the setup. As you know, what we did with Persian incursion was we had variable setups depending upon how the political situation changed. There were different variable upgrades that you could put in depending upon whether or not you thought a particular rumored weapons purchase was happening. And you could argue military details, but a lot of the game happened on the political side, where you were given political points and you had to spend them to accomplish certain aims. The Israelis actually have a very hard row to hoe if they want to bomb these Iranian reactors. It's not about the military side. They can go over there and take on a third-ranked air defense network with their world-class aircraft, and they will get through, and they will hit the target and will destroy it. The only question is whether or not they're going to lose any aircraft at all. They could come back without a scratch on them. So you bomb the reactor. That's not going to change the Israelis' minds. The real target of that Israeli ordinance is the mind of the Iranian leadership, who have to be convinced that a nuclear weapons program is not in their best interest, that there's no future in it, that it's a waste of money, and they should go do other things that are more useful. That's what wargaming is all about. We've got the Harpoon system is continuing to grow and expand. We just came out with Bywater's War, which has done very well. Anybody who
which is part of your overall Admiralty Trilogy series of games.
Yeah, Harpoon actually grew. World War II is Command at Sea, and World War I is Fear God and Dreadnought. Those three are called the Admiralty Trilogy. And they have a common nomenclature, common terms and everything. So if you play one, you're now familiar enough with the other, so you can just go by the rules and play them. You don't have to relearn everything. All 20th century naval combat, and also aerial combat, because you can't play naval combat without air combat being involved. And we took Harpoon, which was this very mature, modern tactical system, and boiled down certain parts of it to make Persian incursion, and it's worked very well for that. But then you can do fun things, like take Hector C. Bywater's The Great Pacific War of 1931, which he wrote in 1929. That was one
the crisis thriller of its day, as it were.
Yeah, it was one of the, there was actually a fairly large genre of those types of stories. Hector's did exceptionally well. It was tremendously popular, and he was a British citizen who had actually spied for Britain during World War I, and was well known within naval community. And he had some things that he wanted to say about naval warfare, but couldn't because of the British Official Secrets Act. So instead he wrote about the U.S. and Japan, which he was free to do. And it was a great story. You read it, and it's a great novel. But he's got all these naval battles in it. And so we turned it into a series of scenarios in Command at Sea. And that came out just earlier this month and is doing very well. We even have an outfit that's doing some ships that were created by Hector C. Bywater in his story that are, you know, in miniature. So you can play with a Matsushima-class aircraft carrier or a Galveston-class heavy cruiser, which, of course, never existed in history but did in his book.
He had a lot of what-if ships and systems in his book.
Exactly. And we play around with all that stuff. And it's an interesting period in naval technology, too, because you got some World War I stuff and some early World War II era stuff starting to show up, and the differences in how it's grown. But it's really just about getting out there and seeing the battles that he wrote about and making them come alive. And that's a lot of fun. We have two or three other projects that are under development right now. One, Mediterranean Fleets, which is going to be about the Italian navies and the Yugoslav and the Greeks and the Turks. You've got the Jerry Mitchell book, Exit Plan, you mentioned. We've got the next one, and that is coming out in May. That one's called Shattered Trident, and that's all about the South China Sea and China and the littoral nations that are surrounding it. And I'm working on another one past that. In fact, I was working on that just before we started talking on the phone.
And your publishers for these particular items are?
Okay. For the books, it's Tor Forge. And I'm on their webpage, but you can also find me on Facebook. And I have my own webpage, larry-bond.com. Clash of Arms publishes all the games, and they've got extensive webpage, but again, linked through Facebook. I do talk to people on Facebook. I check it every day and try and answer all the messages and everything. Not that I get that many, but if somebody writes, I write back.
Been a pleasure talking to you today, and I hope that all of your projects continue to work well. Thank you for sharing with us, and with that, we are out today on Military Monday. Please join us again next week, where we're hoping to have a professional Army Public Affairs and Media Relations officer talk about the challenges and the adventures of telling soldier stories to the press and trying to get them across properly. Thank you very much for Military Monday. This is John Gresham.